From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. A bill before the General Assembly would require every public school in Maryland to hire a school resource officer with law enforcement authority. We talk with Baltimore County Republican Delegate John Cluster, who sponsored the bill, and with Kate Rabb from the nonprofit Advocates for Children and Youth. Then the Ara Noble Ensemble will perform the second of a two-part program at Owings Mills this weekend that traces the story of Jewish musical and cultural life in the 20th century. Tom Hall gets a preview. Plus, our resident fashion expert Zoe Washington has some ideas for consumers concerned about sustainability in fashion.
The idea of getting something locally sourced is a little bit hard to enact in fashion only because there's so much manufacturing that goes into it.
First news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. On the morning of December 14, 2012, a lone gunman shot his way into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. He killed 20 children and 6 adults before turning the gun on himself, all within about 11 minutes. In the days and weeks after the shooting, gun control advocates called for stricter gun laws. Gun rights advocates, like the National Rifle Association's Wayne LaPierre, called for more guns in schools.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
The debate continues. Delegate John Cluster, Republican of Baltimore County, is sponsoring a bill in the General Assembly that would require every school in Maryland to have an armed school resource officer. A House committee heard testimony last week. Delegate Cluster joins us by phone from Annapolis. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And here in the studio with me is Kate Rabb. She's Education Policy Director at the nonprofit Advocates for Children and Youth. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Delegate Cluster, why should public schools across the state be required to invest in something like a school resource officer that they, up to this point, have decided is not necessary?
Well, a lot of them do already have school resource officers. In Baltimore County, we actually have at least one in every high school, one in every middle school, and I'd like to see them go in all the schools. There's about 600 resource officers around the state. We need an additional 900 to fill the schools, and it's about safety. And well, there's two reasons. Safety is number one. As you just said, it was 11 minutes that suspect was inside the school, and you saw 26 people were killed. It's a matter of timing get there. I think the first officer arrived on the scene 7.5 minutes after the call went out. In Colorado, we just had one recently, a school shooting. One of, as I might say, and since 2013, we'd have 94 school shootings since 2013. But the one in Colorado, there was a resource officer in the school. It took him 45 seconds to get there, and only one person was injured. So I think first and foremost, it's a matter of, you know, having somebody there to protect our kids. Secondly, I think it's a good role model for youngsters. You know, as a former police officer myself, I can tell you that, you know, you make friends with these kids and, you know, you become friendly with them and they see you in a different perspective than what they do on a normal basis, which is about 75% of the time. It's a negative contact with the police. We're writing you a ticket. We're, you know, coming to your house to handle a call. We're coming to a domestic or we're locking somebody up. So I think that it's twofold.
Kate Rabb, you don't believe this is a good idea.
I don't.
Why not?
Studies show that SROs in schools don't make schools safer. We see the same
school resource officers,
law enforcement officers. We see the same level of serious crimes in schools that have resource officers and those that don't. But what we do know is that schools that have these law enforcement officers have those officers handle low-level behaviors that educators traditionally have dealt with through the regular discipline process. And we really don't need the criminal justice system handling routine discipline problems. And not only that, but we know that the children who are disproportionately sent into the criminal justice system are students of color and students with disabilities. And given all of this research and the fact that we know that there was, in fact, an SRO at Columbine when that tragedy happened, there is no evidence showing that having people in these schools to police children will make them any safer.
Can I jump in real quick about, she mentioned Columbine. Back in Columbine, there was a different model for active shooters. Back in Columbine, the rules, you know, for engagement were that for, even though there was an officer on the scene, he was to leave the building, wait for the SWAT team to get there, and then re-enter. That has changed. The rules, you know, for active shooters now, the first officer on the scene goes into the building. So, it, you know, when they use Columbine, the police department's learned from Columbine because of what our active shooter policy was. So we've completely revamped our active shooter policy to make sure that the first officer there does go into the building.
But still, you and Kate, in a way, are, I think, talking about different issues. You, Delegate Cluster, are focusing on the intruder who comes in from the outside and is a danger to students. And Kate, you're talking about the activities within the school that might be a danger to students. I don't even know how to ask which is the higher priority. Kate, you're with me, so I'll...
Well, I mean, I think... And Delegate Cluster did also mention this idea of the role model, the person in the school
right.
who's interacting with kids every day. And I think that's really what we're experiencing, what the children in our schools are experiencing, is the police officer who they're interacting with every day and who are not really having the proper training to deal with young people and the problems that they're facing. And we do see, as a result, children being let out in handcuffs for behaviors that otherwise would have just been dealt with in the general education system. For example, a public defender who I work with, who deals with Baltimore City, has had two cases this year of children being brought into the criminal justice system because of a theft of Pokemon cards. In the end, they thought it was because there was an unfair trade. And General Delegate Cluster's bill would put SROs in elementary schools to continue that pattern of our youngest kids having some behavioral problems handled by law enforcement rather than handled by teachers and others in the school who really are trained to know what's educationally appropriate, how to teach kids better behavior, and how to reintegrate them into the school system rather than push them out and lead them down this path.
Delegate Cluster, I want your response to that, but let me just first say this is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast speaking with Kate Rabb, Education Policy Director at Advocates for Children and Youth. And with us by phone is Delegate John Cluster, a retired Baltimore County police sergeant who's introduced a bill in the General Assembly to require all public schools in Maryland to have school resource officers with guns. Delegate Cluster, what about this issue that when there are police in the schools, discipline problems more often are likely to be treated as crimes?
Well, she's citing Baltimore City, and Baltimore City has a different setup than the rest of the state. Baltimore City has school police officers. They don't have school resource officers. So they're not trained like all of the other school resource officers are around the state. There's an organization out there that trains that we require in Baltimore County, and most school districts do require these officers to go to this training where they're taught how to interact with the kids, how to handle the kids. And unfortunately, in Baltimore City, they don't have that. So she's citing incidents in Baltimore City. In Baltimore County, we don't have that problem. In fact, in Baltimore County, one of the schools in my district, and there was an officer named Tony Barr, who was a very good friend of mine. We worked together for years. He was so well-respected in the schools that he stopped more incidents than occurred because the kids in the school actually trusted him. They looked up to him as a role model. And they would come to him and say, you know, Officer Tony, Jimmy John's going to smack Joe in the head at lunchtime because over a girlfriend or over a couple dollars or something. What Tony would do would call those two into his office, straighten out the problem before it happened, and it was resolved. The fact of the matter is that other than making an arrest, which a lot of times the officers are called to the school to do that anyway, the principal has more authority in that school than the school resource officer does. So they're not there to lock people up. And in jurisdictions around the state that have trained resource officers, that's not occurring. That's why I'd like to see all of our resource officers, including Baltimore City, go to these training sessions. And they're required to go, you know, it's a 40 to 80-hour class, and then they're required every year to go back for retraining. So they learn all the new models out there.
Let me let Kate respond.
Kate, It is true that I cited one example from Baltimore City, but the data that I'm talking about based on national studies, and I also know from the advocates and public defenders I work with throughout the state that there are various examples, very much like the one I gave from Baltimore City, about kids having their regular behavior being criminalized. It's also the case that when we're thinking about the fact of all of these SROs being put in every school across the state, that it's incredibly expensive, especially at a time when we're seeing with the governor's budget cuts over $144 million being cut from schools, and schools are facing significant teacher layoffs. In Baltimore City, it's about 400 teachers alone. It's coming out of this the same pot of money, the Education Trust Fund, which is causing where the cuts have come, that's causing a lot of these layouts. And this essentially means that because of this bill, the choice is either putting teachers in classrooms who really know how to deal with kids and work with kids, or having law enforcement officers patrol our hallways. And to me, the choice is clear.
Della Cluster, I know you think that the price tag of $100 million that Legislative Services in Annapolis put on your bill is too high.
Yes.
But it would cost something. It would cost tens of millions.
It would. It would cost about $22 to $23 million. And let's go back to what the young lady said. I mean, they're not cutting money from the school budgets. What they're doing is they're not getting the increase they expected to get. So the same teachers that were hired last year under the current budget, like in Baltimore County, we're getting an additional $28 to $30 million. If we can't keep those same teachers, you know, with that additional money, then there's something wrong with our budgeting process. So, you know, the rhetoric down here is you're cutting. No, we're not cutting. What we're doing is you're not getting the amount of money that you are expected to get, but you're still getting an increase. The majority of the counties around the state are getting an increase. So you're right, it is expensive. But again, ask those parents in Sandy Hook how much their kids are worth. You know, I mean, you don't want to. I've seen kids that were, you know, killed. My first SWAT operation, that I ran a SWAT team for 7 years, I had to go into a house where three kids were killed with a shotgun, and they're huddled in the corner, and ages like 8 or 9 months to about 6 or 7 years old. That's something that nobody should have to see, and nobody should have to go through. And that's what I'm trying to stop.
Kate Rabbit.
Well, I mean, it's a different conversation, but I disagree with the concept of we're not getting education budget cuts. In Baltimore City alone, we're facing $35 million in cuts. 10.5 are coming because of the inflation factor, which has been stopped, and the 50% cut in the geographic cost of education index is another over $11 million. And so there's significant cuts, and we're facing $400 million in 400 teacher jobs potentially lost. But the point is that having SROs in schools doesn't make schools safer. It causes criminalization of our kids because of the day-to-day interactions. And there's no evidence that it would stop a horrible situation like a mass shooter in the school. There's plenty of evidence that it would cause our kids to go into the criminal justice system.
We're out of time and have to leave it there, but I'm grateful to both of you for flagging some of the issues for us. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Delegate John Cluster of Baltimore County, a Republican, he's introduced a bill in the General Assembly that would require all public schools in Maryland to have school resource officers with guns. Kate Rabb is Education Policy Director at Advocates for Children and Youth. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Ahead, music that traces 20th century Jewish musical and cultural lives. 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Morning, everybody. everybody. Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. On Sunday afternoon at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts, a classical chamber group called the Aura Nova Ensemble will present a program of music of Jewish composers from the mid-1800s through today. It's the second in a series of programs organized under the rubric of From Darkness into Light, tracing the contributions of Jewish composers from Mendelssohn and Mahler to contemporary composer like Jonathan Leshnoff, who lives in Baltimore and whose music is performed and recorded regularly by leading orchestras and ensembles across the United States. The ensemble was formed by the violinist Mark Singer. He and other members of the group joined me this morning in the recital hall of the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University, where Mark serves on the faculty. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Tom.
So thanks for being here. So From Darkness into Light is the way you've organized these programs. You did a program a couple of years ago called Suppression and Rebirth. The program you're doing on Sunday is called Exile and Flowering Forth on New Soil. How did you organize the repertoire?
Well, the truth is that I actually started researching this topic when I was working on my doctoral degree at the University of Maryland in College Park. And I found all of these composers that I never knew existed and real masterpieces amongst their works. So it made me kind of take on a mission to make sure that these works are heard more often.
As well as composers that people might not be familiar with, there are some very familiar names,
yes,
but music that's not familiar by
yes,
those
certainly.
Names.
Certainly.
Yeah, and you actually have one of those pieces here to play for us this morning. It's by Gustav Mahler. This is a piece that he wrote as a very young person.
Right. He was 16 years old when he wrote it, and actually he destroyed most of his early works, so we're very lucky to have this work. It's kind of Mahler on hormones, you know, and very passionate, romantic, kind of an obsessive theme that comes back again and again.
Great. Well, let's hear some music of Mahler then, music that he wrote as a teenager. This is his piano quartet featuring the Aura Nova Ensemble here on 88.1.
Thank you.
music of Mahler here on Maryland Morning. That was his piano quartet played by the Aura Nova Ensemble. Dan Wisner on piano, Mark Singer on violin, Victor Huduko on viola, and Ina Estuyus Ben Sasson on cello. Thank you very much, Mark Singer. That was just delightful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And Mr. Mahler was certainly a very serious young man at age 16, wasn't he?
Yes, apparently so.
Is there, just like some people say that there is a particular quality to American music. You know, people think of Aaron Copland or something like that, who was also, as it turns out, a Jewish composer. Yeah. Is there a particular musical identity to a Jewish composer?
That's a very good question and a very difficult one to answer. There are composers whose music is deeply connected to their Jewishness. I think that is probably true of a world premiere that we're going to be playing called Adagio, Journey of the Soul, by Ben Schaefer, who's very learned in terms of Jewish texts. And then there are composers that, you know, they're, for instance, there's a composer, I think Jonathan's music, you don't hear, sometimes there is an overtly musical
message. Jonathan Leshnoff, who lives here in Baltimore, teaches at Towson University.
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think his music, he has written, you know, specifically Jewish music, but also music that, you know, is not particularly based in Judaism.
But John is, of course, a person, because you and I both know him.
Yes,
he's a person of deep faith.
Oh,
and
yes,
Jewish faith is, and Jewish identity to him is very important, certainly. Yeah.
And then we're playing the Shostakovich piano trio in E minor, which is, of course, Shostakovich was not Jewish. However, he identified very strongly with the Jewish people. The piece that we're playing actually was dedicated to the musicologist, the Jewish musicologist, Solartinsky. And it was about the time that word was getting back about the camps, you know, of course, which the Allied forces had liberated. And this piece is also dedicated to the victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah, so it's really quite a broad spectrum
of
old music, new music, and music that's inspired in various ways by Jewish identity. Yeah. The Aura Nova Ensemble will perform music by Ernst Bloch, Jonathan Leshnoff, Ben Schaefer, and Gideon Klein, along with rarely heard works by Mahler and Shostakovich, Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts up in Owings Mills. We've got a link to all the details at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. So what are you going to play for us now? We've got some music of Shostakovich, I guess, huh?
Yes.
And who's going to be playing this? This does not involve the whole quartet. It involves just three of you.
That's correct. It'll be our pianist, Dan Wisner, our cellist, Ina Estuyus Ben Sasson, and myself, Mark Singer, on violin.
All right, music of Shostakovich by the Aura Nova Ensemble. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass, reporting from the campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now back to the show.
It's Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. These days, we talk about sustainable agriculture, sustainable sources of energy, and even sustainable fashion, as fickle and ephemeral as fashion may be. More and more consumers are conscious of how their clothes are made, how much energy and water go into their looks, and what working conditions are like in the countries of manufacture. We've been talking about the issue with our resident fashionista, Zoe Washington, a fashion editor and CEO of the company Little Bird, a fashion consulting service for teens and tweens. And Zoe's with me in the studio. Welcome back, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
What do you mean by sustainable fashion?
Well, when I think of sustainable fashion, I tend to think of what's eco-friendly, but also ethical. And I think that's how most consumers sort of view the whole topic. So not just what it's made of, but how it's made and what the company does, what the practices are around each garment.
It can be hard to square responsibly made clothing with fashionable clothing. So how should consumers approach this?
Well, I think for a while when the idea of sustainable fashion and green fashion really came into full force, I'd say that'd be the early 2000s. People just automatically assumed it meant wearing like a hemp bag and
the fibers, you know, they focused on
the fibers,
fabric content,
exactly. And you know, most people don't understand that, you know, just even an item that's made of cotton can have a really huge impact on the environment.
Walk us through some of that.
Well, I think what it is really is that, you know, cotton takes a lot in order to go from, you know, the fields to your shirt. So what ends up happening is that there's an enormous amount of pesticides that go into it in order to purify cotton, in order to make it wearable. And then there's also the fact that most companies, when they're actually producing and manufacturing the garment, they use an incredible amount of water. And so if you think about how much energy goes into producing that one shirt that you might buy from, say, H&M or Zara, it is really mind-boggling. And I'm surprised that it took this long for it to become an issue, really.
Okay. But clothing doesn't come with a tag with an ingredient list like food.
Exactly.
So how can I know whether the piece of clothing that I'm looking at in the store is environmentally responsible?
No, that's a really good point. And I think that there's some committees that are trying to address that. For example, with the CFDA, the Council of Fashion Designers of America, they're creating a sort of committee on sustainability in order to infuse transparency in the process. And that's really the big issue right now. It's not even just, okay, well, what can we do in order to make everything more sustainable? It's also like, how do we know what that even equals? So you asking, you know, what does sustainable mean is something that the fashion industry is really asking itself. And so what they're requiring is this level of transparency so that companies, especially fast fashion companies, which are really popular right now, offer more transparency to the consumer so we know not just where things come from, but how they're made and what they're made with.
What does locally made mean? I mean, are there, for example, I mean, should I find out about clothes that are made in the Baltimore region and focus on those because they wouldn't be putting the kind of transportation burden on the environmental equation?
I think that it can mean a number of things. Much like when the local vore movement that's happened with food, the idea of getting something locally sourced is a little bit hard to enact in fashion only because there's so much manufacturing that goes into it. So you can design a garment in Baltimore and maybe get fabric from a local company or a local store, and you might even do the samples here. But most likely, you're going to have to send it somewhere else in order to get manufactured, in order to take it to market. And what we're seeing is that it's not so much just local of, okay, well, this is going to be made in my specific town, but even just keeping it in the U.S. is a lot more local than most companies have been doing.
That's fashion editor Zoe Washington here on 88.1 Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Zoe is CEO of the company Little Bird, and we're talking about sustainable fashion. You and I have talked before about the trend of fashion not made to last.
Mm-hmm.
Wear it for a season, maybe even just a few weeks, and move on. It's sort of the opposite of investment dressing.
Exactly.
You mentioned the clothing chain H&M. I mean, it underwrites a lot of serious coverage of these sustainability issues on the website of the Guardian newspaper, mm-hmm. and yet it's big into throwaway culture.
It is. Yeah. I mean, H&M, and I think the reason why they're at the forefront of this is because they are very much part of the problem, which we understand. I mean, fast fashion isn't, it isn't even just, okay, well, you know, all of the, these efforts and all this toxic waste goes into making each garment. It's not just as simple as that. It's the fact of the sheer amount of clothing that's being manufactured. So as fast fashion continues to rise, people are literally buying more clothes and throwing away those clothes for no reason. And then the demand is increased and then manufacturing increases. And so what H&M has really tried to do is to provide a little bit more transparency in terms of where they're actually sourcing and manufacturing their product. And they're making as many efforts as they possibly can in order to adjust what materials they use. And I think that's also another element that's really interesting, this this birth of a new micro industry of how to create through technology new materials that will go into clothing.
New materials that are environmentally sustainable.
New materials that are environmentally sustainable.
So is recycling our closets the answer? That Guardian website ran a report from a fashion journalist who warned nothing but, quote, dumped, discarded, or donated, close quote, clothes for a year. She said she was able to look smashing.
I'm sure she thinks she was. I would, you know, I can't do that. So I don't know what to say there. You know, you
can't. Don't think shopping thrift stores only is the answer?
I think you can do a lot with a little if you already come to the table with a strong sense of fashion and of personal style. So I would say that that's wonderful. Definitely source your local thrift stores. And like H&M is a good example of a company that's really trying to get people to recycle their clothes within their stores. So you and I spoke previously about them offering this initiative of, okay, bring in your clothes. It doesn't even have to be H&M. We will recycle those materials, and then you can get a credit towards your new H&M purchase.
Let me get quickly back to something you raised earlier about transparency. Mm-hmm. I mean, should we look forward and expect soon the day when we actually, on the tag of an article of clothing, can learn what its environmental burden is, what the ethical situation of its workers is? Can we expect that to be disclosed in a very easy to understand way?
I really doubt it. I think that that is where the industry would like to go. But I think that's a lot to put on companies and it's a lot to put on consumers. You know, we have to know so much about every single thing that we purchase. And I think the idea of having to look at each shirt, maybe, you know, at this point, it could be a pair of pants are manufactured in one company that is environmentally sound, and the shirt from the exact same brand is manufactured somewhere else completely. So I think it's a lot to put on a label and to put the burden on consumers. But I think what they need to do is that companies need to be more transparent on their websites about where they're actually sourcing their materials. Even on the luxury, in the luxury sector, you see companies really trying to show you what their efforts are. So, for example, Stella McCartney, which is a very well-regarded luxury brand, she is really obsessed with her carbon footprint, and she is, you know, well-known for being a vegan and not using any leather goods. But she's also a pioneer in terms of vegetable dyes.
As opposed to chemical
dyes. So I think it's about being an educated consumer, for sure, but I think that just, that's so much responsibility to put on both manufacturers, brands, and the consumer to know where each and every garment comes from. I think it's all about simplifying the supply chain.
Zoe, thank you.
Thank you.
Zoe Washington, fashion editor and CEO of the company Little Bird, a fashion consulting service for the teen and tween demographic. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning, including a link to The Guardian's sustainable fashion site. More of this interview there, too. Marilyn Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1914, the Maryland General Assembly failed to pass a bill that would have legalized Sunday baseball games. We're back on Friday. Please join us.